Mine is, I abandoned my mother at 15, just as she'd been abandoned by my father. I was not an easy child to put up with, and she was just a child herself. She always did her best and was with me in the hospital for 5 months after the coma. When your colon explodes because of overuse of opiates, the prudent thing to do is not ask for opiates to solve the situation, which is, of course, what I did. And they gave them to me. I was impossibly depressed and, as always, wanted to feel better. Also, the hole in my stomach, the one that you could fit a bowling ball in, was ample excuse to get pain medication. Just so you're following along, I had come within inches of dying because of opiates, and I asked the doctors to solve that problem with opiates. So no, even after the catastrophic event, I was not done. I hadn't learned anything. I still wanted to use. When I got out of the hospital after the explosion, I was actually looking really good. I'd lost a lot of weight, but I was so injured that they couldn't do surgery to replace the bag for at least another 9 months. So I went home to my apartment, lied to everyone about the severity of the pain to get pain medication. I was not actually in pain. It was more an annoyance than pain. But doctors believed the lie and gave me tons of opiates. And obviously, I started smoking again. And that was kind of my life. And let's not forget, the colostomy bag was constantly breaking, regularly, 50 times at least, leaving me with shit all over me. Dear colostomy bag people, make a bag that doesn't break, you fucking morons. Did I make you laugh on Friends? If so, don't put shit all over my face. When an addict takes a pill, they feel euphoric. But after a short while, the pill doesn't make them euphoric anymore because a tolerance is built up. But the addict still really, really wants to feel euphoric again, so they take two instead to get the feeling that one originally gave them. Then two is not enough, and they go to three. In the past, I had played that little game until the number got up to 55 pills a day. Just watched the second half of season 3 of Friends. I was so frail and skinny and sick. It definitely showed. But no one said anything about it. The UCLA hospital was giving me opiates for my fake stomach pain, but I needed more. So I called a drug dealer. But I was on the 40th floor of that building in Century City, and that meant I had to figure out a way to go down 40 floors, give the dealer the money in an empty cigarette pack, and get my pills. Then I had to get back to the 40th floor unnoticed, take the pills, and I would get to feel good for a while. Now, I had to do this with a sober companion, a nurse, and Aaron all living in the apartment. Turns out I was terrible at it. I tried 4 times and got caught exactly 4 times. The UCLA doctors were not pleased with this and said I had to go to rehab. I had no choice. I was addicted to everything they gave me. Had I just said no, fuck off, it might have been a glorious moment, but then the drugs would stop, and I would get crazy sick. I was put in a rather strange position of choosing where I'd be locked up for months, given the choice of New York or Houston. Maybe somebody more capable than me should be given that decision. I, being the least qualified to make any decisions, picked New York. I was high as a kite and fakely clutching my stomach when we arrived at the recovery center in New York. Even though the place resembled a prison, the people in there were all smiles. "The fuck are you guys so happy about?" I said. I had a tendency to be a bit grumpy. I was on 14 milligrams of Ativan and 60 milligrams of OxyContin. I had a colostomy bag. I asked where I could smoke and was told there would be no smoking here. "Well, I can't stay here if I can't smoke," I said. "Well, you can't smoke here. Yeah, I heard what you said. How in the world am I supposed to quit smoking on top of everything else? We'll give you a patch. Don't blame me if I smoke the actual fucking patch, I said. It was agreed that they would keep me on the Ativan, put me on Suboxone, and I could smoke during the detox, but not when I was on the main unit. This meant that I could smoke for 4 more days. When I wanted to smoke, the staff member would escort me outside and stand next to me while I puffed away. That was relaxing. 3 nights went by, and then I met a very pretty, extremely smart nurse. She took very good care of me, and I flirted with her as much as you can flirt with someone who is changing your colostomy bag on the reg. The dreaded day where I would have to quit smoking was looming. So, I was allowed to walk out with the wonderful nurse to get coffee. Accordingly, my mood lifted a bit. I made jokes. I flirted in that we're all in rehab, so nothing can really happen way, as we returned. Back at the center, the nurse said, "I need you to do something for me." "Whatever you need," I said. "I need you to stop trying to fuck the hot nurse." She was referring to herself. Jesus. I thought we were both flirting in a safe, never-gonna-happen kind of way, I said. I was there for 4 more months. I never flirted with her again. Nor did she flirt back at my non-flirting, perhaps because she'd seen me covered in my own shit multiple times. I moved up to the unit, met therapist Bruce, Wendy, whatever, whom I wanted nothing to do with. All I wanted to do was smoke, or talk about smoking. Or smoke while talking about smoking. Everyone just looked like a giant cigarette. I rarely left my room. The bag kept breaking. I called my mother and asked her to come save me. She said that I would smoke if I left, and that would be awful for the upcoming surgery. I called my therapist, begged her to get me out. She said the same thing my mom had. I was fucked and stuck. Panic set in. My bag was full, I was not high, there was nothing separating me from me. I felt like a little kid scared of monsters in the dark. But was I the monster? I found the stairwell. The nurse? Nowhere to be found. Therapy? Fuck therapy. I hit those walls with my head just as hard as Jimmy Connors used to hit his forehands down the line. Lots of topspin, right on the fucking line. Stairwells. I'm this close to dying every day. I don't have another sobriety in me. If I went out, I would never be able to come back. And if I went out, I would go hard. I would have to go hard because my tolerance is so high. It's not like the Amy Winehouse story where she was sober for a while and then the first drink she had killed her. She said something in that documentary that is true for me, too. She had just won a Grammy, and she said to a friend, "I can't enjoy this unless I'm drunk." The idea of being famous, the idea of being rich, the idea of being me, I can't enjoy any of it unless I'm high. And I can't think of love without wanting to be high. I lack a spiritual connection that protects me from these feelings. That's why I'm a seeker. The first time I reached 55 pills a day, like the character Betsy Malum in Dope Sick, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that I was addicted. I'm one of the first famous people who went to rehab and people knew about it. In 1997, I was on the number one TV show in America, and I went to rehab, and it was on the cover of all the magazines. But I had no idea what was happening to me. Betsy Malum in Dope Sick graduates to heroin and it's sayonara. You see her just kind of nod out, smile, and die. But that smile is the feeling that I wanted all the time. She must have felt so good, but it killed her. But that beatific moment is something I still seek, only without the death part. I want a connection. I want that connection to something bigger than me because I'm convinced it's the only thing that will truly save my life. I don't want to die. I'm scared to die. I'm not even good at finding the drugs. Somebody at one point that I worked with introduced me to a crooked doctor. I would claim that I had migraine headaches, actually. I had maybe 8 doctors going for my made-up migraines, and I would still sit through a 45-minute MRI to get drugs. Sometimes, when things were really bad, I'd go to a drug dealer's house. The nurse of the doctor took over from him when he died. She had all the pills, and she lived in the valley, and whenever I wanted to get pills, I would go see her. I'd be terrified the entire time. She'd say, "Come in." "No," I shouted. "We're going to get arrested. Just take the money and let me get out of here." Later, she wanted me to sit down and do coke with her. I'd get the pills, and because I was so terrified, I'd take 3 instantly and drive home and be high to take the edge off the fear, which just meant I was even more arrestable. Much later, when I lived in Century City, I'd try to find excuses to go down 40 stories to score. I was so sick and so injured at the time, my stomach hadn't closed yet. I was alone during COVID. I had a nurse on staff giving me drugs, but I wasn't getting high from them anymore. So I would call a drug dealer and get more oxy. This way, I'd have additional drugs to the ones I'd been prescribed, so that I could actually feel them. The street pills were something like $75 per pill, so I was giving the guy $3,000 at a time, many times a week. But I got caught more times than I was able to pull it off. The UCLA doctor in charge of my case got fed up with me and told me he wouldn't help me anymore. I couldn't really blame him. Everybody was terrified about fentanyl being in the pills and me dying from them. When I got to the treatment center, sure enough, I tested positive for fentanyl. This disease, the big horrible thing, addiction, has ruined so much of my life it isn't funny. It ruined relationships. It ruined the day-to-day process of being me. I have a friend who doesn't have any money, lives in a rent-controlled apartment, never made it as an actor, has diabetes, is constantly worried about money, doesn't work, and I would trade places with him in a second. In fact, I would give up all the money, all the fame, all the stuff to live in a rent-controlled apartment. I'd trade being worried about money all the time to not have this disease, this addiction. And not only do I have the disease, but I also have it bad. I have it as bad as you can have it. In fact, it's backs to the wall time all the time. It's gonna kill me. I guess something has to. Robert Downey Jr., talking about his addiction, once said, "It's like having a gun in my mouth with my finger on the trigger, and I like the taste of the metal." I got it. I understood that. Even on good days, when I'm sober and I'm looking forward, it's still with me all the time. There's still a gun. Fortunately, I guess, there's not enough opiates in the world to make me high anymore. I have a very, very, very low bottom. Things have to get truly awful. They have to get big and terrible before I quit anything. When I was doing the show Mr. Sunshine, I was basically running it, writing it, starring in it. Then at home, I was working on notes for a writer on a script that he had written. I had a bottle of vodka next to me. I made myself 13, 14 drinks, but homemade drinks, so triples. After about the 14th drink, I wasn't drunk anymore. So I quit drinking. I think I'm now at the point with opiates where it's the same situation. There just isn't enough. I took 1,800 milligrams of opiates in Switzerland per day, and it wasn't enough. So what am I going to do? Call a drug dealer and ask for all the drugs? Now, when I think of an OxyContin, my mind flashes directly to having a colostomy bag for life, which is something I could not handle. That's why I think it'll be pretty easy for me to continue being off opiates. They don't work anymore. And I could wake up from another surgery, There have already been 14 since the first one, with an irreversible colostomy bag. It's time to figure something else out. As said, the next level is heroin, and I won't go there. Me quitting drinking and opiates doesn't have anything to do with strength, by the way. It just doesn't work anymore. If somebody came into my house right now and said, here's 100 milligrams of Oxy, I'd say, it's not enough. The problem remains, though. I'm there wherever I go. I bring along the problems and the darkness and the shit, so every time I leave a rehab, I do a geographic and buy a new fucking house. And then I live in it. And the first thing I used to do when I looked at houses, which is a hobby of mine, was go through the homeowner's medicine cabinets to see if they had any pills I could purloin. You can't be a dick about it, though. You have to take the right amount. You can't take too many or they'll know for sure. So you check the date on the pill bottle. You want something that's sort of out of date. If it's been a long time out of date, you can take a bunch of them. But if it's brand new, you could only take a couple. I would hit 5 open houses on a Sunday. That'd be my whole day. At one point, when I was taking 55 pills a day, I would wake up and somehow have to find those 55 pills. It was like a full-time job. My whole life was math. I need 8 to get home. Then I'll be there for 3 hours, so I need 4 more. And then I have to go to a dinner party, so I need 7 for that. And all this just to maintain, to not be sick, to avoid the inevitable, which is detox. I imagine those homeowners arriving back after their open house and eventually at some point opening their medicine cabinet. Is it possible that Chandler? No, not Chandler. Surely not Chandler Bing. Now, instead of open houses, I'm having one built. I started the process because about 18 months ago, I couldn't complete a sentence. Things got so flat, so awful for me. Doctors came in, my mother came in, everybody came in and took care of me because I couldn't talk. I was so out of it. I had to do something. I had that $20 million penthouse apartment in Century City where I was doing drugs and watching TV and having sex with my girlfriend of a few months. One night, I passed out and she was passed out, and when we woke up, my mother and Keith Morrison were at the foot of my bed. I thought, am I in an episode of Dateline? And if I am, why is my mother also in it? My mother looked at my girlfriend and said, I think it's time for you to leave. This saved my life. My dad has saved my life multiple times, too. When he helped me get to Marina Del Rey after Jamie Tarsus had told me I was disappearing before her eyes, I was deathly afraid that I would never have fun again for the rest of my life. After about 3 weeks, I called Marta Kaufman and David Crane to tell them I was sober and could return to friends. When are you coming back? They said. We need you to come back. It's going to be very work intensive. We have to start in 2 weeks or we won't be able to do it. But I was still very sick. My father had overheard the tenor of the conversation and called Marta and David back. I will pull him off your television show, Dad said, if you continue to act this way around him. I was so grateful for him, for being my dad and doing the dad thing. But I also didn't want to be the problem. They were just doing their job. They had the number one hit TV show, and 2 of the main characters were about to get married. I couldn't just disappear. I just wanted everything to be okay. So then I moved from Marina Del Rey to Promises in Malibu and was told I was going to need more than 28 days. I would need months to get better from this. 2 weeks later, I was driven to the set of Friends by a technician from Malibu. When I arrived, Jen Aniston said, I've been mad at you. Honey, I said, if you knew what I'd been through, you would not be mad at me. With that, we hugged, and I got the work done. I married Monica and got driven back to the treatment center. At the height of my highest point in Friends, the highest point in my career, the iconic moment on the iconic show, in a pickup truck helmed by a sober technician. Not all the lights were green on Sunset that night, let me tell you. I can't be useful in a relationship because I'm both trying to hang on and in so much fear that I'll be left. And that fear is not even real, because in my 53 years, and with all the wonderful girls I've had, I've only been